Welcome back to Broad Minded with the Broads, Molly and Christine.
Here, Mark Malkin from eOnline. Also, Dr. Hema. She's a dermatologist. She's going to come on. And Chelsea Kaplan. But right now, he's a regular broad. Patrick Wannis is here. He is a human behavior expert and clinical hypnotherapist, PhD. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So, welcome back. We're just talking about this young boy. It's been all over the news, the 8-year-old boy that killed his father and his friend with a rifle. And so we thought you could give us some insight into brain development because we just can't get our head, we can't fathom that an 8-year-old boy would do something like this and premeditated.
Yes, you're right. And there's a lot of elements to this. I think first up we have to say that the only person that knows the real truth are the two people who were murdered and the murderer, meaning that, yes, this 8-year-old boy has confessed to premeditated murder. Now, is it a real confession? Was he coerced? We don't know that yet. There are also many other elements to this story that make it very interesting, because it's not just a case of, well, he may have been holding the gun in his hand, it was an accidental shooting. The murder of his father happened downstairs, and the murder of the second man, who was a boarder in that same house, happened upstairs. Mm. So whoever murdered one then had to go upstairs or downstairs to murder the other. The third point is that the mother, the natural mother, who's not living with him, who lives in Mississippi, happened to be visiting him just a few days before this event. So there are a number of variables. Having said that, this is a very small community. And according to them, this boy has not been in any trouble. There's been no report of abuse. According to the community, this boy and his father get along very well. They've played sport together. They were described as being two peas in a pod. Now, the key element here first starts with the confession. Now, the police received a confession from him without a lawyer present, without his parents present. Now,
see, isn't that going to be, that won't be able to be used?
Well, that's going to be the question in court, whether they can actually use a confession. But there's an important element to that, too, because this is a small community. So in this sort of community, you could just imagine where most people know each other, and the police go up to the boy and say, son, what happened? Did you do this? Versus taking him into a police station, making sure there's a lawyer, making sure there's a parent present. They may have been just asking him off the cuff. And I don't. And that also changes the story a little bit. But I want to add this information, because everyone's saying, if this kid is guilty, now the fact that he's confessed doesn't make him guilty, and I'll tell you why. In September 1958, there was an 8-year-old boy by the name of Melvin Dean Nehmer, whose parents were stabbed to death in their Long Island home. Now, this little boy initially told police that a masked intruder not only had killed his parents, but had also tried to strangle him. Now, 3 days later, after intensive interrogation, the little boy starts crying and breaks down and confesses. However, his innocence is eventually established when a medical report comes out which corroborates his initial story. And in that report, which apparently had been concealed for weeks, fingerprints proved that this kid couldn't have strangled his parents or stabbed them to death.
Mm.
So my point being that we have to first make sure that is this a real confession? And here's why I say that. At the age of 8, we tend to be compliant to authority. We tend to be submissive. We can also be afraid of authority, particularly if you're an 8-year-old boy and you've just experienced something traumatic, whether it's the murder or whether witnessing the dead body of your father. This boy is traumatized, so we don't know what his initial response is going to be when authorities are saying, who did this? Who's the gun? Whose is the gun? Did you have the gun, etc., etc.? Now, of course, there's a lot of speculation going on across the internet right now and across the media. A lot of bloggers saying, well, it's, you know, this kid shouldn't have had a gun. Well, again, he's in a small community. Now, what's interesting is his father taught him to shoot with a gun and taught him to hunt dogs on the prairie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was trained. This is a bonding he did with his father, was hunting.
Right. Now, we can say that it was bonding with his father. Then someone else can say, well, he was taught to kill. Someone else can say he was taught to use a gun. Now, all of those elements are true. Now let's look at the brain, because this is an important part. The whole reason that we usually do not accept that a child can be responsible or be cognizant of his actions at such a young age is because of the brain development. See, a lot of people think that, oh, as soon as you're born, your brain's fully developed. No, it's not. There are some things that are hardwired, but not everything. And the most important part of the brain that keeps developing is what we call the frontal part of the brain, the frontal lobe. So your brain keeps developing into your 20s, which is why we turn around to teenagers and go, what the hell were you thinking? How did you do this? How is it possible you could have done such a stupid thing? The frontal part of the brain is associated with judgment, you know, with what's right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the brain doesn't fully develop until after the teen years, either at the end of the teen years or even in the early 20s. So think of an 8-year-old boy.
Yes, and you know, that's very true, because even in this area, Patrick, it's been on the news, especially in Maryland. There's been, and Christine, you've probably seen this on the local news, mm-hmm. all these teen fatal car accidents. And what they're finding is that they were speeding, and there was no judgment. And there's just been a slew of them in the past year of teenagers dying in car accidents due to bad judgment, poor judgment in driving a car. I mean, we used to think it was cool. Oh, who cares? Don't be a grandpa. No, you have to be a defensive driver, because lives have been lost because of it, and it's probably because of that judgment. It's just not fully developed.
Right, so that's a key element. Now, the other aspect to the brain relates to the ability to experience and feel and process empathy. Now, there's a lot of studies that have been done, particularly recently, on neuroimaging or imaging of the brain, scanning of the brain, to try and determine activity of the brain of a psychopath.
Right.
Now, it's important first to define what a psychopath is, and that's simply someone who has aggressive, antisocial personalities and lacks emotional empathy. That's the kind of person that can commit unbelievably hideous crimes, be it rape or murder, and they show no signs of remorse or guilt. What's been found is that people with psychopathic tendencies or disorders lack empathy because they have defects in processing facial and vocal expressions of distress, such as fear and sadness. Now, let me say that in very simple terms.
In other words, they're not expressing their fear, they're not expressing their sadness, and so therefore that's a sign?
No. In fact, it's really quite different than that. It's that they can be hurting someone, but while they're hurting that person, even though the person could be screaming out in pain or has a facial expression, they don't process that as pain. They don't feel that as pain, which explains why many young children can easily engage in acts that we see as cruel. I mean, let's face it, a lot of animal cruelty happens at a young age.
Yeah,
kids
that's
don't
true.
Experience
yeah.
the pain as they... You know, they think it's funny to do this to a cat or do that to a dog or to do
this
to a mouse. Oh, God.
But you're right. They don't think that they're hurting them. They don't. You're right. It doesn't process that way.
They're not experiencing the empathy. They're not feeling the pain, which is one of the key lessons that parents try to teach their children. When you're trying to teach a child about what's right and wrong, for example, you'll see it in a school, in a classroom. Kids will gang up on a girl and they'll do something. They'll put chewing gum in her hair or they'll make fun of her. Or the girls will do it to each other or to a boy. Now, how does the teacher help them? The teacher can punish them, or the teacher can sit down and say, imagine now what it would be like if you were the one that had the chewing gum put in your hair or if you were the one that was being mocked. Mm-hmm. So they try to get them into the state of feeling the pain of the other person. That's empathy. And what they found with neuroimaging of psychopaths is that the amygdala, which is a very small part of the brain that stores not only a lot of the memories, but it conditions fear. So that's how we sort of get into the fight or flight response. They found that either that was smaller or there wasn't a connection between it and the frontal lobe. And I just said the frontal lobe, the frontal part of the brain, is the judgment. So they can be engaging in acts and they don't experience the empathy, they haven't fully processed. Now, I don't know if that's the case with this 8-year-old boy. There are so many elements. It may simply be a case of, you know, he was taught to hunt dogs, and maybe he hasn't experienced the pain of what a dog goes through when it's being shot. He may have not been cognizant of anything that was going on. Now, on the other spectrum, this, and we don't know this at all, but say, for example, the child was abused. Now, maybe he experienced enough pain where he turned around and retaliated or try to end the pain. But does that explain the murder of the person upstairs, the other man? No, it doesn't. We also don't know what is going on in the child's life in respect to his relationship with his natural mother and with his stepmother. So I guess what I'm saying is there are so many variables here and there are so many unknown elements that the judge in the case correctly gagged the case until it's over, so meaning that no one's going to know what's really happened until it's all over.
Mm. In other words, it's true. We don't have enough evidence, or we don't really know the full story yet about this child. But in general, it just seems that, you just think if a child could just go out and kill somebody with no remorse and nothing, and there's
no... We don't know that he did.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm not talking about him. That's pretty scary that a child could just learn that behavior and just go shoot somebody if they're... I mean, I'm not saying I'm hoping there's abuse, but we want an answer. We want some reasoning behind this. And if we find out that he's been abused, then at least in our minds we can say, well, now we've got some sort of reasoning. But if there's no reasoning for this kind of thing, how do you study these cases and how long do you study them to figure out, how to solve these problems?
Well, I think you're going to find that they're already engaging in psychological evaluations of the child, and there are going to be so many questions that are going to be asked of the child. And then we also need to look at the cultural aspect. And there's the cultural aspect of he's a small boy living in a rural area who's been in which the community, tends to feel very comfortable around guns. And then we don't know what else he engaged in. And when I talk about the culture, today's culture where we are constantly bombarded, if that's the right expression to use, with images of violence and murder and death and killing, where we do become desensitized to it. And then you have to ask yourself the question, does an 8-year-old understand the permanency of death? Does he understand the implications of death? Does he understand what he's doing if he was the one that pulled the trigger of his father? And we still have to say, even if he was being abused, well, why did the other person get killed? Now, the two of them, the father and the other victim, both worked at the same, I believe, factory. So we don't know what that relationship was.
Right, I know.
So there's so many variables. We don't know if that other man was involved in some sort of abuse, or if the other man killed the father, or if the father killed the man and then the boy went and killed the... I mean, there are so many possible scenarios.
Yeah, like the guy killed the dad and the boy went and killed the man who killed his dad isn't a possibility.
That's also a possibility. I mean, there's so many scenarios. But I think really that what we want to take away from this is, as parents, be aware that your child's brain is still developing. Your child, so therefore, you can actually scientifically show them that they are still, their brain is still growing, their brain is still developing, and for that reason, it's easy for them to have impaired judgment.
Mm. It's so important that this boy does not end up in juvenile where he won't get help. It's like he's 8 years old. There is a chance to help this kid so that he can have a life. It's just our system is messed up.
Well, I don't know that it's the system because we don't know what's going to happen with the child. Where is he going to end up and what sort of treatment is he going to get? Is he going to get real treatment or are they going to put him on medication and how is the medication going to affect him? Again, there are so many variables.
And does he even have an advocate? I mean, they're not even sure if the mother's going to claim him or whose parents are going to come in. I mean, who's there for him right now? Is there any family members? That's another question.
And then we go to the next question is, the father had custody of the child. Why did the father have custody of the child and not the mother who lives in another state, Mississippi? Was it because she moved away? Was it because she didn't want custody? Is there something that happened with her? Does she have some habit that may have impacted the child in some way? I mean, there's so much that needs to be asked and answered. But I think, as I said, the first point for parents is, be aware and explain to your teenage children that their brain is still developing, which would account for impaired judgment and might help you in then trying to say to them, look, you need to be careful because you can make the wrong decision.
Mm. See, Mom and Dad, my brain wasn't developed yet when I did all those bad things. It's not my fault. I think it's still not developed, Christine. I still think
I hope
like
my mom's listening.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show, Patrick. We'll talk to you probably in a couple weeks.
All right, take care.
Bye, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick.
Bye.